This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is made possible in part each Wednesday by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do, a better business relationship. By Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. By Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. By Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. And by the over 1,000 VBSR members. Here's noted Vermont author David Goodman.
Welcome back to this week's Vermont Conversation. My guest this week is Rebecca Holcomb, the Secretary of Education for Vermont. Secretary Holcomb joined the Agency of Education as its second secretary in January 2014. Prior to joining the agency, Secretary Holcomb taught at the middle school, high school, and university levels. She taught social studies and science before becoming the principal at the Fairley School. And while at the Fairley School, she helped lead the district through the formation of the Rivendell Interstate School District. Secretary Holcomb researched issues related to high-stakes testings and worked on projects related to organizational learning, school leadership, and principal development while pursuing her doctorate at Harvard. She attended Brown University as an undergrad. Secretary Rebecca Holcomb, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here today.
So you are 3 months into this job. What has been the most challenging part of the job so far?
Honestly, probably the move from Montpelier to Barrie, where we're trying to support the legislature at a very, very busy time. There's just a lot going on, and I have a wonderful, wonderful staff, and they're working very hard to keep the regular work going, even as they take on that work of moving.
So, like anybody who worked lower down in an organization, you've been now a teacher, a principal. Surely you fantasized back in those days about what it'd be like if you ran the joint. So now you do, and the joint is the whole state. What's on? What would have been on your wish list as a teacher and principal? And now that you're secretary, what can you actually address that would have been on that wish list?
Well, truthfully, I think at every level in the system, we're really doing the same thing, which is thinking hard and constantly working to try to improve the learning of our students. And that's what you do in the classroom as a teacher, where you run the joint in your classroom. It's what you do as a principal when you have a bigger classroom in some ways, and you're trying hard to look at your school, look at what's working, look at what's not working effectively, and help put in place support and systems that help make it possible for students to learn better and learn the many things they need to thrive in civil society and jobs and careers wherever they choose to go. And at the agency, that's really the same thing. It's getting into the conversations with all the many parties in Vermont who are deeply invested in our schools and working really hard every day to try to make sure that every child in every classroom has the best teacher possible.
So when you were working as an educator, mm-hmm. was there one thing you wished you could do if you were higher up on the totem pole, and what would that have been?
I would like, this may not be what you're asking for, I would like people to understand how incredibly complex teaching is. And it was ironic to be for a while a developer of teachers and to try to have to demonstrate the competencies of all my graduates before they were certified to be a teacher. Because what you know when you're in the classroom is that being a skilled teacher isn't about being able to do 40 different discrete things. It's about being able to know which of those things is the right intervention at the right moment for a given child based on what you're seeing. It's the ability to integrate that in real time. I think unless you've stood in a classroom and really tried to work with the 20 kids, it's hard to understand how complex and what an incredible amount of expertise is involved in teaching well.
Now, when you grew up, your parents worked for the United Nations and you attended international schools. How did that prepare you or not for working in public schools, which you've spent much of your adult life doing?
I think I've probably been in more schools than most people I know. And so I think one advantage is I've been in a lot of different schools with a lot of different students from all over the world in all sorts of contexts. I actually was homeschooled for a while as well because we lived in Afghanistan and subsequently in Pakistan. And in both those places, political troubles closed our schools and my parents had to either educate me or send me, give me to the wolves. So I've had a lot of breadth of experience that way. And certainly, you know, the government schools in Afghanistan, Pakistan, they were really supported by the U.S. government. And they were functionally public schools with public school teachers who were certified in the U.S. but working overseas to support international families, but also American students who lived abroad. I think when you've seen many different kinds of schools, it forces you to ask questions and think about what is it that makes a good school. And the more models you see, the more ideas you have about that. So I think that's one benefit I have. And I think the same goes for, I was talking about this with someone earlier today. When I first became a principal, it was an aha moment for me because I actually realized what all teachers need, which is the opportunity to see lots of different teachers teaching in their classrooms. And I think the more teaching you get the opportunity to observe, the easier it is to start to really think about what it is that's effective. And, you know, that at the end of the day, that's what schools are all about. How do you understand each child and figure out what it is they need to move them that next step in their educational journey?
So just backing up to Afghanistan, well, and what were the other countries that you were a student in?
I've been a student in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Spain. I also spent time with my family in China and the Fiji Islands.
What did your parents do?
They did development work for the United Nations, mostly economic development.
So in Afghanistan, famously, girls often do not have the opportunity to go to school. Talk about that. What did you see with girls' education in Afghanistan?
Well, I think at the time, well, first of all, I was in Afghanistan a very long time ago, and certainly before the rise of the Taliban. And I think history has been very hard. Recent history has been very hard in that country, and it is true that life for many women and girls in Afghanistan was very challenging. It was also very challenging for many boys in that country as well. And,
right.
I think it was a low life expectancy and lower levels of education overall. I think, you know, I do feel I have to say that there's also a tradition of Afghanistan of very strong women. And really that tradition is one that has struggled of, you know, in recent years under the political parties that have been involved.
Hmm. So were girls able to go to school when you were there?
I think some girls did and some girls didn't.
Yeah. You're listening to the Vermont Conversation. We're talking with Vermont Secretary of Education Rebecca Holcomb. You can join the conversation by calling 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. This year has been a pretty tough one for Vermont schools. 35 school budgets failed, the most since 2003. What's the problem with school funding in Vermont, and how do we solve it?
I think the answer to that depends who you speak to, doesn't it? You know, and certainly if you read the newspaper or talk to the legislature, you'll hear, you know, a host of different answers. From the perspective of the agency, what we are seeing is some patterns in which budgets are running into the most trouble. And there seem to be several pretty common drivers behind some of the big increases in budget, you know, in the tax price that led voters to vote budgets down. One of them is, I think the elephant in the room, is the declining enrollments. The state's seen almost a 20% drop in enrollment over the last several years. And because of the formula returns revenue to the school districts based on per pupil enrollments, if you have a declining number of students, even if you level fund your budget, you are going to receive less money to do it. So to maintain that level of funding, you're going to actually have, put that wrong. If you're to maintain the same level of funding, because you're reimbursing a per pupil rate, the tax rate that you will have to pay to support that maintained level of funding will have to go up.
So what is the, there are a lot of solutions being batted around now. What do you see as the one that is most supportive of education and yet balances the financial realities that we're in?
Well, I I don't want to borrow a line from Bill Clinton, but I feel the school's pain. I mean, you probably know that the agency itself has seen a 30% reduction in staffing over the last, you know, 5 to 7 years. So we understand this problem. We understand that the mandate and the mission of schools hasn't narrowed. But we also realize that the resources that are there have diminished. We just don't have that capacity to support all these options that people may have wanted to. So I think the challenge is to constantly ask ourselves, you know, what is it we want for our children? And from that, go back to what is the best way to provide it and be open to the fact that by engaging in vigorous conversations, we might find different solutions or different strategies that enable us to provide the quality and the level of education we want for our students, but perhaps in some creative ways.
We've heard about formulas to, you know, raise the base rate so that it cushions what you have to pay locally. Do any of these things, and then there are a lot of questions about revisiting Act 60 and 68. A proposal was just floated by two of the Republican House leaders in Vermont to repeal them. Mm-hmm. What is your take on that? And what has Act 60 and 68 actually done for Vermont?
I think what Act 60 and 68... I mean, it's one of the more progressive education formulas in the country, and by design, it was intended to narrow the variability in what districts were able to spend on educating their children so that the kinds of resources your community had to support your children weren't a function of your family or your town's wealth, and I think or income. And I think that's a really powerful point. I mean, what you're saying is that part of civil society is that people should have substantively equal opportunities to grow up, thrive, and be part of a strong education system. You know, depending on which of the solutions you're talking about, some of them are nibbling around the edges and won't really fundamentally address the underlying issues. Some of them are really challenging the notion of whether we do want a progressive education funding formula. And I think those are debates that are currently taking place in the legislature. I think that the underlying issue is we will have to grapple with this issue of declining enrollments and look at the fact that our costs have continued to grow, that we have as many teachers as we've had even before some of these declines started. We have an increasing number of one-on-one aides or in the special education field. And so I think part of it is looking hard at how we deliver our education and asking if there are other ways to maybe do it that will be more sustainable about, you know, in the long run. I think the fact that so many, we talk about the 35 budgets that went down. I think it's important to remember the overwhelming majority of budgets passed. Even though people do feel pinched, this is a state with a very strong tradition of support for education. And what I don't hear Vermonters saying is that we don't believe in our schools or we don't want to support our schools. We're going to have to look hard and see if there are ways to make it more affordable, particularly in the towns that are really struggling with declining enrollments.
How do you answer critics who say, how do we have school budgets going up when enrollments are going down?
I think there are people have a lot of answers to that. I think we are seeing, one is that we have economic unity across the state, but we make our budgeting decisions politically, we make them independently. So I think that there's a disconnect between people don't understand that sometimes that the decisions they make are sometimes driving the increases at the state level. And once someone asked me about the increase that was projected in the overall ed spending before the votes, that was a projection based on the local budgets that we'd seen. So we were estimating the percent increase we expected voters to approve. So it wasn't a state level decision to raise spending. Individually, when we put our budgets together, what we're generating is an increase in the ed spending if we're increasing what we spend. I think one of the, you know, in terms of rising costs and why they're increasing, I think there are a series of hard conversations we also have to have at the agency. And one of the things we've been doing is speaking with people, who represent special educators, the superintendents, the school boards, and asking, you know, whether there's a way to look at the way we reimburse and support special education services to see if there might be more effective ways to deliver high quality services that kids really do need, but in a way that might be more cost effective. Mm. So I think everything's on the table. We have to be looking at that and having vigorous conversations and asking those questions.
You've said that one of your priorities is to close the gaps in learning opportunities, and that public education, you've said, is the civil rights issue of our time. What do you mean by that?
I mean several things. Going back to your question about Afghanistan, I mean, I think one of the things that I think it's easy to underestimate when you grow up in this country is the power of freely available public education. When people are literate, when people are well-educated, when they're numerate, when they know how to interpret statistics, we are able to have a level of discourse and able to weigh our collective priorities and goals in ways that you can't when people don't have access to education. And, you know, one of the things I love about Vermont is that we're not afraid to come to the table and, you know, have verbal fisticuffs and really debate issues that we care about it. But at the end of the day, we're all part of one community, and we can do so respectfully. And that's not a privilege that everybody in this world has. And I do believe that education is foundational that way. And it's why in Vermont we don't just care about English language and math because they're tested, but why we also care about civics and history and the arts, because we know a well-rounded person needs exposure to learning across all those domains so that they can do that. In terms of equity, what we see happening in terms of the job market and the kinds of job opportunities that are available to kids is a real polarization in terms of opportunities. I think technology and globalization in particular have driven a divide where the jobs that are going to compensate families and kids well in the future are ones that involve a set of higher skills, the 21st century skills that everyone's talking about, the ability to deal with non-routine problems, to reason from evidence, to be persuasive, to think creatively. And those are the jobs that people have to do that computers can't do, and that's why they'll be compensated. What you see at the other end of the spectrum is there will continue to be jobs that people have to do in the food services, but they don't always pay a livable wage. And this is another issue being debated in the legislature right now. What should the minimum wage be? And part of the problem is you have more people competing for some of those jobs. There's sort of a deflationary pressure on those wages as well. And I think that's a real problem. We can't just educate people to a basic level, because when they graduate, there won't be opportunities available for them that will help them thrive and raise families and participate in our civic life. There will always be jobs in Vermont that aren't, you know, on computers or dealing with international living. I mean, but even to be a skilled craftsperson or a farmer right now, you need that ability to be comfortable with technology. You need to be able to be resourceful and constantly adapt, constantly reinvent yourself in your work. And those are the kinds of capabilities that maybe you can't measure so easily on standardized tests, but we know we need to cultivate in our children. And that's the role of public education.
We're talking today on the Vermont Conversation with Secretary of Education Rebecca Holcomb. You just referred to equity. And mm-hmm. What does equity in education look like?
I think this is one of those things that define. I think that when I think of equity, it means that the opportunities that you have to learn, to improve, shouldn't be governed by some circumstance of your birth. That's fundamentally American, and it's fundamentally the responsibility of a civil society. And I think what you see in some other places is that the advantages that you get are a function of your wealth or your family's income, and whether you can purchase access into certain levels of society and certain kinds of quality educational opportunities. And I think that offends some people's sense of equity. Does it mean that we're all going to end up doing the same things in life? Absolutely not. Some people will always be different. People will always aspire to different things. And I relish that. But the question is, did you have the opportunity to improve yourself? Did you have access to a teacher who had the skills and the time and the disposition to really help you realize your goals and get where you wanted to go? Or were you not given those opportunities, so that really you left school early, you ended up with marginal opportunities? So I don't see equity being everyone doing the same thing, ending up the same place or looking the same, but it's certainly about having the opportunity to get the skills and the capabilities you need to get where you want to go in life.
One of the concerns that people sometimes talk about in reference to equity is, does it require taking from some and giving to others? Taking from some who've perhaps benefited in the current system to give to others who have been lagging?
you know, several generations ago, and I've told this story, so I apologize to any listeners who've heard it already, but it's a formative experience for me. Several generations ago, my grandmother came to the United States as an immigrant. She didn't speak English, and she learned English in public schools. Her family situation was challenging. Her mother passed away, and her dad had problems with alcohol, and she ended up being put in foster care. And she left school when she was in 10th grade to go to work so she could get out of the foster care system. And, you know, she ended up marrying, had my mother and my uncle, and her husband died. And so she, on a 10th grade education, had to support her children. And because of the opportunities she had to learn English and get enough skills that she could work first as a bank teller and then as a private secretary, she was able to support my mother. It was not easy. My mother talks about growing up and getting to the end of the month, and there was no food in the fridge. My uncle ended up going off to live at the Girard College for Orphan Boys because my grandmother couldn't support him. But here I am another generation later, and I'm sitting here as the Secretary of Education in Vermont because she was able to get my mother into a good public school, and eventually my mother got a scholarship that took her to a private high school and then to college. Full scholarship all the way. We were lucky. I mean, I'm lucky, and I'm here today because somebody saw my mother and gave her an opportunity. But I'm so mindful that that was a matter of luck. There was another kid just like my mother who never had that chance to go to college. And the children of that mother, they're not sitting here today in this seat. And so I'm just mindful that it's not enough to have luck be what gets you to where you want to go in life. That there needs to be a way for other children to have opportunities as well. And again, one of the things I value about public education is in public dollars. And by public education, I'm also, you know, in Vermont, we have a strong tradition of historical academies and other schools that use public dollars to educate children. But what it is that we're providing them is a base, a platform that they can stand on to get access to high-quality education, to get where they aspire to go in life.
So one of the things we're seeing in Vermont is, I think it was in North Bennington, where you had a public school privatized, and now the legislature is trying to address that. Nationally, the debate rages over charter schools, which are privately run, publicly funded, privately run. Feel free to correct my characterization. Vermont has been maybe a little bit unusual in that this issue has not really been at the center of our education debate. What is your take on charter schools, and particularly as they relate to Vermont?
Well, I think right now they don't. We don't have charter schools here. So they don't. You know? I think what we do have is a strong tradition. I mean, when you think about I've look back in the statute at one point. The historical academies were initially founded as public schools with a different form of governance. That's the actual language that was in the statute. And what they were private schools that served a public mission. And if you go back and look at the websites of some of these institutions, they still embrace that mission. And they welcome all comers. And that's something that I think is critical. And I think that some of the pushback in other states, I'm not talking about Vermont because this doesn't happen here, but what you do see in some other states is that there are there's some very good charter schools. There's some absolutely terrible charter schools, just as there are some good public schools and some public schools that really aren't so great and probably ought to do a lot of work to get better. Overall, there's no real difference in performance between the two sectors. It's just that that they're different governance structures. What you do see in some places is that some of the charters have been able to take advantage of a significant amount of philanthropic funding outside the public funding as well. So I would say that some of them are partially funded by public dollars. And then the other thing you do see in some cases, which does trouble me, is problems with attrition, where certain kids, they come in, but they don't stay in. And so they're pushed back into the public system. Or there are cases certainly where if you look at the demographics of the charter school are very different from the local public schools. They tend to have more girl students because girls are, I think, easier to educate in some ways. They tend to have fewer special education students, fewer students with English language learning needs. And so what worries me is when we start to set up separate institutions that are parallel, but one is coping disproportionately with the financial challenge of supporting students who have perhaps more intense learning needs but are equally deserving of support and opportunities to learn. And so I think that's where some of the national conflict has come.
Okay, we've been talking with Vermont Secretary of Education Rebecca Holcomb. We'll be back in the second half hour to continue the conversation.
Hi, this is Eric Bashaw from the all-new 802 Honda. I shouldn't say all-new, because the familiar faces you know from Town & Country Honda are still here. We want to make sure all the things customers love about us stay the same. Listen to what our customers have to say about us.
I always take it to the service department. I think it's a reliable car. I like the style of it. My husband and I have purchased six Accords from 1987 to 2013.
You can expect the same high level of customer satisfaction that our customers brag about while also offering prices that can't be beat. You'll never have to leave Vermont to get your best deal on your new or certified Honda. We're driving to be your number one Honda dealer in Vermont. We're easy to find. Click on 802honda.com and research your next car. Call 802-223-9700 and speak to one of our no-pressure sales consultants. Drive, take 89 to exit 7. We are less than 1 minute off the interstate. 802 Honda, driving to be your number one Honda dealer in Vermont.
AP Update. I'm Tim McGuire. As the search goes on for that missing Malaysian Airlines jet, investigators have reached out for help in retrieving files that were apparently deleted from the flight simulator found in the pilot's home. Sagar Magani has more.
Malaysia's acting transport minister says some records on the pilot's home flight simulator were erased last month.
Forensic work to retrieve this data is ongoing.
A U.S. official says the FBI's been given some electronic data to analyze as the massive search for the plane continues.
This is the search sector that's been assigned to American forces.
Colonel Steve Warren, a Pentagon spokesman, pointing to a spot on the map about 1,500 nautical miles west of the Australian coast, where a U.S. surveillance aircraft is scouring the southern Indian Ocean. Sagar Meghani at the Pentagon.
The plane with 239 people on board has been missing since early in the morning on March 8th on what was until then a routine flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire.
Waterbury Rotary invites you to visit the 21st Waterbury Home Show. Visit the show at the Crossetbrook Middle School on March 22nd and 23rd. Visit with exhibitors, bid in the silent auction, grab a bargain at the flea market, or take part in the pet costume contest. New this year, enter the worn out jeans contest or take part in the belt sander racing. Make your way to Waterbury on March 22nd and 23rd and follow the signs. For information and contest rules, visit waterburyhomeshow.com.
The new Formula Ford is the best place to go for the best-selling car on the planet, the Ford Focus.
But what if I want an SUV?
The new Formula Ford has the Ford Escape, a top 10.
Or maybe a truck.
Well, the new Formula Ford is the best place to go for the F-Series, the bestseller for 37 years running.
Wait, and what if I want high pressure, high prices, and lousy customer service?
Then you should go somewhere else. Right on the roundabout at the junction of 302 and Route 2 in Montpelier. And at FormulaFordVT.com.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility makes the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman available each Wednesday, along with People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow. Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. And Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. As well as over 1,000 plus VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation, where this week we're talking about all things education with Vermont Secretary of Education Rebecca Holcomb. Secretary Holcomb, one of the focuses of your academic research has been high-stakes testing. What is the state of high-stakes testing in Vermont?
Well, the good news for, in my opinion, is that we don't have it to the same way extent that other states do. And as you may know, that 46 of the 50 states applied for a waiver under from No Child Left Behind under Race to the Top. And what that does is it requires them to tie evaluation of teachers to the performance of those teachers' students on test scores, so that we would be required to evaluate the teachers in all of our schools based on how well their students do on standardized tests like the NECAP or the tests that we'll be introducing and piloting actually now, the Smarter Balance Assessment, and then introducing next year in the spring. And, you know, this is a very controversial subject nationally. In my own experience, I'm glad we don't do that, because I think I value a test. I embrace a good test. And in Vermont, we've been able to use our tests to learn a lot about how effective we are at educating children. For example, we know that systematically young boys from low-income backgrounds, regardless of their race, don't do as well as girls in the state of Vermont, and don't do as well as students from more affluent backgrounds. And we need to know that, because we need to use that information to think hard about what we can do to teach more effectively to those students, to engage them in school and bring them back to the education table so that they can develop those skills we think they need to be effective. My concern about high stakes and high stakes use of testing is that it can set up some perverse incentives that can undercut the integrity and the quality of the education you're trying to provide. For example, in Vermont, and if you go back and look at the recently approved education quality standards, we care about a lot more than just English, language, arts, and math. We know those are critical gateway skills, but we also care about science inquiry. We care about civics and social studies. We care about wellness. We care about school culture and whether our students are developing the skills they need to function in democratic society. And we care about the arts. We know that creativity is critical to many of the jobs that are being developed. And we also know that culture and artistic expression are powerful forms of communication, and truthfully what brings many of our students to school every day. And when we attach very high stakes to only two or three subjects, what we do is really discourage or create incentives for teachers to diminish their focus on some of those other critical outcomes for students. And that's something that really worries us.
And teaching to the test.
Teaching to the test is what people call it. And then the other piece is just, I'm fairly convinced it just won't be fair. When we look at the value-added models, which is what people call the models for evaluating teachers, or the growth models, what we see is they're very, very unstable in small classes. In fact, many of the studies, the research we're reading, they throw out classes with 15 or fewer students from the models because they're so unstable. So teachers may be ranked very high or very low just by chance, based on measurement error, who happens to be in the class. And it doesn't give you a real estimate of the value the teachers are bringing to the table. And there are other things as well. During my doctoral research, I was interviewing principals, and one of the things that I kept hearing was that some students are just more challenging to educate, and some teachers are just more effective with those students than other teachers are. And one of the things that several principals said to me was, we want to have the flexibility to know we can place the students with the teachers who will be most effective with them, because that's what every child needs and that's what's right for the kid. But if we start to grade teachers based on that, what we're doing is we're going to punish teachers who are really effective with those children and create incentives for us not to place students with the teachers who will best serve them.
We're talking on the Vermont Conversation with Secretary of Education Rebecca Holcomb. You can join the conversation by calling 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Around the country, there are some very big school districts, Westchester County, New York, Seattle, that where teachers or the districts themselves are voting to stop all high-stakes testing. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that? Does that make sense for Vermont?
Well, it's again another paradoxical piece about Vermont is that because we didn't apply for a waiver, we're still subject to No Child Left Behind. And under No Child Left Behind, if every single student in the school didn't score as proficient by 2014, a school would be considered a failing school. So by that definition, we expect and assume all schools in Vermont are now failing schools. And, you know, you're on a school board.
Yes.
You know, think about that. Is your school failing? You know, and it's not that there aren't things that we can and we should do better. And we embrace the opportunity to continuously ask ourselves and work to make our schools better. But, you know, the same USDOE that tells us our schools are failing is also the USDOE that published a report that put us seventh in the world behind Massachusetts and some nation states like Singapore in math and science. And I'm not sure, actually, that seventh in the world in Singapore, on the TIMSS test, which is the test they use to make the comparison, makes me feel that we've got it all done, we can go home. I still think we have a lot of work to do here. But, you know, it doesn't... we don't have high stakes the way anymore. I mean, if everyone's failing, then we can all just say okay and go home and do what we really know matters, which is just focus on continuous improvement and helping every school get better with every child. And we're all in this together, and we can get out of that high stakes game of naming and blaming and labeling.
So the big... thing on the horizon in the education world nationally that people are hearing a lot about is Common Core. Can you explain what it is and what will change in Vermont as a result of it?
Well, the Common Core has been on the Vermont landscape for several years now, so it's not new. It just has been getting more attention in the state as the foam, you know, the ferment and the news nationally heats up around the Common Core. One of the things, again, that's different is because...
Well, just define what it is, the Common Core curriculum.
The Common Core is an aspirational document that it's an effort to describe what we think students need to know and be able to do in order to thrive in college and careers when they leave our school system. And from those, the end goals that were defined for the Common Core... the people who worked on it worked to sort of back plan to what were sort of goalposts or targets for each grade level that we'd like students to know and be able to do. So, again, it's an aspirational effort. It's sort of the best document we have at the moment to describe what we want our students to be learning and what level of mastery we want for them at each sort of step in their educational journey. It's that said... We still know we need Vermont teachers to do what they've always done, which is look at each individual child and ask where they are in that journey and develop appropriate instruction. And the example I've been giving is that when, you know, I was a principal in a K through 8 elementary school, and one of the things you realize in kindergarten is some kids come to you in kindergarten and they know how to read chapter books. Some kids have never seen a book. And before you can teach the kid who's never seen a book how to read, you need to help them understand that letters are associated with sounds. But even more importantly, you need to give them a purpose to read. They need to know that you read to have fun, for pleasure, and that you can read to learn things. And until they know that, you can't teach them how to read. So what good teaching is very different for those kinds of kids. So regardless of what's on paper, the core can't replace the high-quality professional judgment of our teachers. And we're hoping that all of our teachers will continue to hold those high aspirations as outlined in the core, but also use their professional judgment about how to get kids there at the local level. And it's not a curriculum. It's just a set of goals.
Now, in some places, so this set of goals, and these are proficiencies, and the idea is to have students... It's not about seat time anymore. You don't just sit in a seat. You go through for all of 10th grade and you graduate 10th grade. Now you have to prove you have reached these certain proficiencies.
Well, that would be the assessment system.
Yeah.
We are trying to move that way. And certainly when you look at the work around the personalized learning plans in Vermont and then some of the interesting work being done in the League of Innovative Schools around developing performance-based assessments that will give students opportunities to demonstrate proficiency on those indicators in the standards. That is an effort, and the idea is to move kids so that they can find opportunities to personalize, to serve internships, perhaps go early to college and experience a college-level course. These are all ways that we hope to use opportunities that we have to help push students farther if they need it and maybe give them a little more practical application if they need it to help sure that they all reach the same goals, but recognize that they have different paths for getting there.
Are we asking the right questions in education? Do we focus more on managing kids and money instead of how to best educate every child?
Well, you asked me what one of the hardest things was when I first started talking this hour. And I actually, one of the things that is surprising to me is how hard it is to actually talk about teaching and learning in this job because the attention often does come back to money. And I think that is a challenge because at the end of the day, the money is, we need to do both, but the money is for the learning. And, it's a challenge.
I've been struck in the current conversation and the frustration over funding and tax increases that don't mirror spending increases, that everybody is leaving open the possibility that nothing may change, that it is just expensive to have a high-quality education in a small state such as ours.
I think that there is a cost to very small class sizes. And it was interesting. I was listening to a presentation by someone from the PISA test recently. And one of the things that he was showing is that if you're trying to improve outcomes, small classes is a pretty expensive way to do it. There are other things that you can do that are more effective. And when we talk about small classes in the research literature, we're talking about class sizes of 15, and many classes in Vermont are much, much smaller than that. And so I do think there is a cost, tremendous cost, in our current system that isn't going to translate into outcomes as measured by many of our current tools. Whether or not Vermont schools just, you know, continue to sustain that is a decision of local communities at this point. The other thing that I think is worth just acknowledging is it's very difficult in Vermont to analyze statewide what are effective systems, because we have so many different kinds of systems and the costs in each system are parked at different levels, some in SUs, some at the local district level, depending whether you're a K-6 system, a K-8 system, a K-12 system. It's very difficult to really compare how we do school because we have so many different ways of doing school. And so some of the answers are there, and I think there are tremendous innovative experiments going on in the state. But it's not going to be easy to answer some of those questions. We're going to have to dig hard and do some close examination.
We're talking with Secretary of Education in Vermont, Rebecca Holcomb. What have been some of the more interesting innovations that you've seen going on in Vermont? Tell me about one or two of them.
Boy, there's a lot. I mean, I think the personalized learning plan is. You know, I'm really excited about that. I think
explain what it is.
It's really and encourage people to go to our website also and look up some of the supporting materials around it. But at the most fundamental level, what it does is it forces the teacher, the parent, and the child to sit down as the child begins to enter the secondary system, and talk about what are the goals. What are the kinds of things that child wants to do? And then to think about what are the kinds of opportunities or experiences or classes or internships that child needs to pursue to go where they want to go. So I think it's powerful because it brings together the key people in that child's life to have those conversations. And it teaches the child to manage their own learning, to think ahead about goals and how you work towards longer-term goals, which are critical life skills for kids if they want to persevere, whether in college or the careers. And it also challenges us, when you think, you talked about proficiency before, to really think about what it is, what will it look like if a child has mastered something, and what are the best ways for different kids to learn it. One of the best classes I ever saw was in mathematics, was actually a boat building class. And there are kids who are able to do incredible things in implied context, same math. But if you just sit them down with a worksheet, they just can't show it. They can't show you what they can do. So, you know, I think what personalized learning plans do is give us a way to focus on the strengths of children and build on those strengths systematically to help them move towards where it is they want to go with school.
How is that any different than what a kid already does in ninth grade, sits down with her guidance counselor and kind of sketches out what high school will look like and then checks in periodically?
Well, do you have a high school student?
Yes.
I mean, I know that my high school didn't talk to me when my daughter goes. So I think that there's more. I mean, I think it's good for the child to do it. But I think it creates an opportunity for a child to have those conversations. And I think, you know, in a high-functioning system, yes, the guidance counselor knows every child and is dealing with them. And I also know that there's some schools where there's one guidance counselor and 400 kids, and they're probably not checking in on those kids and getting to know them personally and making sure that the courses that they're thinking about really are the right courses for them, given where they want to go. So if you look at the personalized learning plans, what it's really trying to do is, again, find one adult who's going to be invested in that child's pathway through school and help work with them over time to personalize that learning and get them where they need to go. And, you know, I think it's...
Mentioned the guidance counselor serving 400 kids. So mm-hmm. Is there money attached to this that allows that guidance counselor to have the time to now do this sort of personalized?
You know, I'm not sure, you know, it's no comment on the guidance counselors in my child's school, but they're wonderful for so many kids. If my child wanted advice, that's not the person they'd go to. And it's just because of who my child is. It's in, and you know, the right adult might not be that one person. And so really, you know, I think schools are going to find different ways to do this. Some schools have advisory systems. Some have mentoring relationships they set up. Sometimes it's a homeroom situation. You know, I think different schools are finding different solutions or strategies for it. But I think the principle is, are we working to personalize learning and to make sure that to the extent possible, you know, we can customize what kids do. We're not creating widgets. We're not, you know, not every kid benefits from the same progression. Just because all ninth graders take, you know, methods, it doesn't mean that every child is really going to get the most out of that sequence. And it's really just challenging us to stop, take a deep breath, and ask what this child's strengths are and where they need to go.
What grade are your kids in?
I have a sixth grader and an eighth grader.
What have you learned from your children that you might not have known being Secretary of Education?
Well, what my son was really upset about was that I don't have the authority to call snow days. I have wonderful kids. I mean, I've really been blessed. I'm also blessed because, you know, certainly the schools are in right now are wonderful schools. And truthfully, it is such a relief to me to be able to send them to school and know that I don't have to worry. You know, that's a huge relief. And I think it's something every parent should have. What have I learned from them? I think what I've learned from having children is that you can be a very, very good school, may not be very good for every child. And kids really, really are different. And they can come out of the same home and just be very, very different. And it's all good. They're just different.
Mm-hmm.
And they need different things.
Let me ask you about some of the hot button issues that are being debated in Vermont. Last night was a big hearing in the State House mm-hmm. about consolidating school districts, mm-hmm. going from what are the numbers? How many supervisory unions we have now to being K through 12 districts? Mm-hmm. Can you explain the problem and what your take is on this consolidation proposal?
Oh, I think I assume you're having someone come in from House Education at some point to talk to you as well about this. What I can tell you I'm hearing, and, you know, I'm commenting on it from the outside, you know, decisions about governance are best made by elected officials. You know, we're going to support whatever outcomes comes out of this. It's not our place to decide how Vermont governs itself. What's striking to me about this whole conversation is that it's been driven in part by the VSA, the Vermont Superintendents Association, the VSBO, the business officers, and the Vermont School Boards Association, who are really talking about the challenges that they feel their stakeholders are feeling in providing a coherent education at an affordable price for our kids. And, you know, I think there is, when kids leave and then go into different opportunities, it's sometimes hard to build consistency across systems. And I think that's one of the educational challenges people have talked about. I know that statewide, we have over 30% turnover of superintendents this year. We have 30% turnover annually of principals in the state of Vermont. And we have pretty high turnover in some communities of teachers. We have areas of the state that really just are having trouble holding on to people long enough to keep this work of getting better going. And I think that's a real concern. And I think that when I went and talked to a group of superintendents, one of the things that some of them were saying is that if you are in a district and you have, you know, 6, 8, 10 different boards you work with, depending on how much collaboration there is across those systems, you end up doing every task 6, 8, 10 times. And so you spend a lot of your time just doing the basic work. And what you don't get are opportunities to really lead a coherent agenda to improve the learning and to coordinate resources around professional development, improvement of teaching practice. And so those are the kinds of concerns I hear from those groups. From the VSBO, I hear things like there's a district up in the Northeast that has 14 different towns. Each of those towns, because of their own governing units, they have to get a separate audit. You know, so you have 14 audits, but they're all in one supervisory union. If governance was up a level, instead of 14 audits, you'd be doing one. It's an administrative burden at the local level, and some of those schools are very small. Affordable Care Act, very complex. You know, you're in a very small district. You have to repeat that process of building the knowledge about how to adjust that and work out health plans for your employees that are meaningful. And it's, you know, it breaks my brain thinking about it. I'm thinking about all these business managers across the state. So there's a lot of reasons I'm hearing on that side. I haven't heard anyone say that governance change alone is going to bring us better education. What I have heard some of these stakeholder groups say is they think it will give us a better chance at it. And what it will also give us is analyzable units. It's easier to compare strategies across K-12 units than it is across a K-12, a K-6, a K-10, a K-8, whatever it is that people are organized in.
But interestingly, Bill Talbot from your office testified that consolidating may cost up to $11 million. Mm-hmm. So cost savings is not one of the benefits of consolidation.
I think that there's tremendous transition costs, and I wouldn't advise anyone to say that this is going to save money in the short run. Mm-hmm. I think that the hope is to, you know, the phrase I keep hearing them using in House Ed is bend the cost curve to try to slow down growth over time, because what we're seeing is increasing costs, and hopefully to use units to develop regional solutions. Again, I don't know where this is going to go. I don't know what's going to come out of it. I don't even know what the final bill is going to look like. That's still being developed today.
What is your take on extending the school year, which is being debated in some communities, notably Burlington?
What we know from the research on learning and out-of-school time is that people estimate that up to two-thirds of the observed achievement gap can be attributed to time spent out of school. So that if you really want to close these gaps, you need to provide high-quality opportunities for kids, particularly from disadvantaged low-income backgrounds, to have continued learning after school or through the school year. And people ask why, what could explain that difference? And I think a lot of it has to do with the very rich summer opportunities that high-income families can afford to purchase for their kids. When they go home, they continue to learn. And when they come back, if you tested them, their test scores would be even higher than the previous June because they've been reading, doing math, working on Lego robotics competitions, doing science investigations in camp, whatever it is that they do over the summer, that keeps them questioning and learning and being enriched. Whereas, other kids, and, certainly I saw this in some of my own districts, and it's why in Rivendell and Fairley we started a summer program. Other kids go home, they're left alone all day watching television because their parents both have to work and they can't afford to put them in a summer program. The gaps between those children will just continue to expand all the way through school and compound over time if we don't provide opportunities for these kids. And I want to go back to something you said earlier. You asked about equity, and is equity something that you can achieve without taking away something from somebody else? I think that's a narrow way of thinking about it, because I think in the short run, that might be a transactional, sort of relationship. I have to pay higher taxes to pay for that kid's school. But I would just put back the social cost of having a growing, poorly educated underclass, which is going to be supported. I mean, this is a profound investment in human capital, in our students, so that they can grow up and be employed and provide for their own families in the future. So the long-term cost of not supporting children and not closing some of these gaps is a price that we're going to pay. We're just going to pay it in 20 years. And I think that's certainly the research behind some of the early childhood education push that's happening right now. We know that that investments in high quality early childhood education pays off down the road in lower teen pregnancy, greater rates of employment, higher income over a lifetime, all sorts of factors that we know are critical to our economic health.
And finally, what do you hope your contribution will be to education in Vermont when you're done with this job?
Oh boy! If I could say that I've done something to support teachers in improving the learning of our children, and that people feel positive about education and positive about the work we're doing to try to help our students be the best prepared students they can be, I'd be happy with that.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Rebecca Holcomb, Secretary of Education of Vermont, for joining us on the Vermont Conversation this week.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Been listening to the Vermont Conversation with host David Goodman. Tune in next Wednesday when once again Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and its over 1,000 VBSR members, along with Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint, National Life Insurance for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow, People's United Bank, find out what know-how can do, and Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to patient, community, and medicine since 1879, as well as Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. These all help to bring you David Goodman with this special program.
Coming right up at 2 o'clock, World and National News Update. 2 hours of music with the Getaway. I'm locally on an operated 96.1 WDEV FM in Warren, FM 96.5 in Barrie, and AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier.
AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire, Russian speaking.